made a mistake. Parker took a slow step forward.
"Was that Snowflake?" he said quietly.
Pollini looked around hesitantly.
"I said at least I'm smart enough not to get shaved bald."
Parker pulled out his K-bar.
"Hey, man," Cortell said, "put away that shit." "I don't take no shit like that," he said to Cortell, but stayed focused on Pollini. "Maybe you and Jesus do."
Pollini started to back away, looking for help. He fell backward into a partially dug fighting hole. Parker was on him instantly, knocking the wind from him with his knees. Pollini gasped in tiny, ineffectual breaths, his face contorted.
"What's the matter, white boy, not smart enough to breathe?"
Parker had the point of his K-bar's blade pressed against Pollini's Adam's apple. Every time Pollini tried to gasp for air, the motion would jab the knife's point against it. There was the sound of a round being chambered, and then Williams's calm cowboy voice.
"Parker, I'll shoot you if you don't get off of him." "That's right," Parker said, still holding the knife to Pollini's throat. "You protect your little sawed-off brother here."
He looked around him, angry.
"We're my own brothers, huh?"
Mallory laid his M60 on the ground and pulled his .45 from its holster. He shoved back the action and let it snap forward, chambering around. His hand was shaking, but the pistol pointed at Williams.
"Now there," Parker said. "We even up, ain't we, Williams?"
At this point, Jackson intervened. He quietly said,
"Okay, you two, put the shit down. This between Parker and Short Round, not between Chucks and Splibs."
"It might not be between Chucks and Splibs," Parker said, his knife still on Pollini's Adam's apple.
In a tight, constricted whisper, Pollini wheezed,
"I take it back. I didn't mean nothing, Parker."
"Well, you didn't, huh? I had to cut your nuts off for what you said, but I'm going to let you go because you're so fucking stupid. But I don't forget things."
He looked up at Williams, who stood his ground with the M16.
"Come on, you two,"
Jackson said, ignoring Parker and addressing Mallory and Williams.
"Put the shit down. We got an ambush to run tonight."
Then he moved into the line of fire between the two of them. Williams flicked his eyes quickly at Jackson, then lowered his rifle and put the safety on. Mallory eased the hammer up the .45 forward.
"It's just between you and me now, Short Round," Parker said. "And I'm going to let you go because you're so stupid."
He pushed back from Pollini, smiling, and stood up. Then he jumped in the air and stomped hard on Pollini's stomach with his boot. Pollini cried out in pain, and Williams immediately ran for Parker, slamming his rifle against the side of his head. Parker came around in a low crouch, swinging the knife, just missing Williams. Jackson tackled Williams, rolling him away from Parker's knife as they hit the ground, knocking the rifle aside. He stayed on top of Williams, who struggled to get free, and turned his head to Parker.
"You keep the fuck back," he said.
They heard the sound of running feet. Bass had his heavy short-timer stick and was shouting,
"What the fuck's going on around here?"
The lieutenant was just behind him. Parker put his K-bar back in its sheath.
"What the fuck's going on, Jackson?"
Bass asked. Pollini was retching in the partially dug hole.
"Nothing, Sergeant Bass," Jackson said. "Williams and I got into an argument."
Malice went over to Pollini.
"Who the hell got into an argument with Short Round?" he asked.
He put his hand on Pollini's shoulder. "Who was it?"
"No one, sir,"
Pollini answered. He was doubled over, tears running into the vomit on his chin.
"I fell in this fucking hole, honest, sir."
Bass turned to Parker.
"Listen, you fucking puke."
"It's okay, Sergeant Bass," Mellis said quickly.
"Sir, I know this fucking excuse for a man. It's okay, Sergeant Bass. I'd string him up by his nuts."
"We'll handle this with office hours," Mellis looked around.
"Everybody here, fighting while on duty. We'll take care of it when we get in. God damn it, I'll bust every one of you."
Williams and Jackson got up off the ground. Williams checked his rifle for dirt, brushing it off, moving the mechanism. Pollini struggled to his feet. Bass picked up Polini's rifle, now covered with mud, and handed it to him.
You better get it cleaned up, he growled.
He stalked back to his hole. Mellis looked around at everyone. Mallory was trying to look as though he was inspecting his .45.
I don't care what happened right now, Mellis said. We'll deal with it later. We got an ambush to set up in about 20 minutes.
Polini stifled a groan. He had his rifle in two pieces.
You able to go on the ambush short round?
Mellis asked.
Yes, sir.
Polini suddenly grinned at Mellis and held up the two muddy halves of the rifle.
I thought I'd get it real clean so it'd open right up when we sprang the ambush, sir.
That was good thinking, Polini.
Yeah, short round, he a real sharp dude.
Knock it off, Parker, Mellis said. You're in enough trouble. He turned to Jackson. I want this squad ready to go in 10 minutes. Get the shine off their faces. When Mellis returned, Cortell was rubbing unnecessarily large amounts of mud and charcoal onto Polini's face. Mellis wanted to say something right away, but was reluctant to show favoritism. Polini was trying to be a good sport.
"Hey, Lieutenant," he said, "make him stop."
Mellis couldn't help laughing. Polini was just funny to look at.
"Go a little easy on him, Cortell," Mellis finally said. Cortell stopped rubbing it in so hard.
Jackson arrived.
"Don't look so worried," Mellis said to him. "It's bad enough with me looking worried."
Jackson smiled, but his anxiety was clear to Mellis, who hadn't really thought about the ambush yet. Suddenly Mellis realized he still didn't know what he was doing. His mind started to churn through all the relevant points he'd been taught about ambushes: front and rear security, assembly points, initiating signals, communications wire or string to tug on for silent signals, kill zones. The mechanics of sudden death were as complex as they were violent. The Marines of 3rd Squad collected around Mellis, waiting nervously in silence. Mellis began figuring.
I'm guessing the trail will take a bend somewhere. We'll set up an L-shaped ambush. Mallory, you'll be on the little end of the L with the M60 and shooting straight down the trail, so if you miss someone in front, you'll hit someone behind him. Just make sure you get the gun pegged in so you don't shoot off the trail in the dark and hit one of us.
Mallory nodded.
Tillman, you'll be next to me with shotgun rounds. We'll need 2 men each for front and rear security. You got a team for that, Jackson?
Jackson thought a moment.
Yeah. Cortell, you can lay out in the boonies for a while.
Cortell groaned. His friend Williams cleared his throat and looked into the jungle. Cortell spoke up.
Shit, Jackson, you get some power and you turn on your friend just like that.
He snapped his fingers. Jackson nodded his head in affirmation and smiled at him. Cortell looked at Mellis.
What can I say, sir?
Nothing. Mellis waited a second.
Who you want in front and who you want in back?
It was Cortell's fire team. It was his choice.
I'd take Williams up front with me. Parker and Chadwick can go behind.
Mellis was relieved. For a moment he feared that Polini was in Cortell's team with Parker. Then he remembered. Polini was with the team headed by Amarillo, the kid who kept doggedly telling everyone that if they had to nickname him something that meant yellow in Spanish, the least they could do was pronounce it correctly. Of course no one did. It had become a running joke.
Okay, then. No one makes a move or fires a shot until I do. If the unit is too big for us to handle, I'm going to just put my head down and hope like hell they walk on by.
Mellis turned to Cortell.
The warning will be 3 tugs on the comm wire. We'll give 3 back. Then you give a pull for every man you count going by you. Same for you, Parker. Everybody got it?
They all nodded.
Okay. I'll select the assembly area about 20 meters off the trail. We'll move into position from there. Everyone meets there afterward. If you get separated, we'll wait 10 minutes. If you don't make it back by then, we'll assume you're hit. Don't move. We'll get you if it takes the whole company.
Jackson spoke up.
The code word tonight is monkey cat, so if any of you dudes gets lost, make sure you holler monkey before you try and come home.
He grinned. Williams and Amarillo let out brief bursts of air just short of laughter. With night encroaching, voices all around the perimeter were dropping to whispers. Mellis looked around at the group. They were all carrying poncho liners, ammunition, and grenades. Their faces were black, and their bush covers were pulled down low or crumpled. Helmets weren't used on ambushes because the profile was too easily recognizable. As the squad filed past the holes in the twilight, the rest of the company was still digging in. Mellis selected an ambush site about 200 meters down the trail and located the assembly area, and they moved into position quietly, stringing wire from hand to hand and out to the security teams. Mellis chose a very dense part of the jungle on a slight downhill slope, figuring that anyone coming uphill bearing a load would probably have his head down and be breathing hard, making it harder to see and hear. The trail curved sharply, and at the bend Mallory and Barber, the A-gunner, set up the machine gun. Mellis took the middle of the long side, next to Jackson, who had taken the radio. They settled in to wait. It got dark. Black. Sightless dark. Mellis could no longer see the trail in front of him. The darkness seemed to push down on him from the clouds. He heard Jackson breathing next to him. His own wristwatch sounded like an alarm clock. He tried to stuff it under his belly, but the effort itself made noise, so he stopped. It occurred to him that if the NVA could hear his wristwatch, they deserved to live. But did they deserve to die if they couldn't hear it? It was a zero-sum game. One side won only if the other side lost. Mellis was starting to nod off. He struggled to alertness and gave one tug on the wire. Everyone awake? There was a tug back from both sides. Everyone was awake. Mellis shivered. God damn the cold and the dark. Impenetrable blackness. He was blind. He felt the fog settle in low through the thick jungle, whispering about them. The radio, set on the company frequency at its lowest volume, made a quiet hiss. If you're all secure, key your handset 2 times. It was Bass back inside the company's position on the radio. Mellis keyed twice, having taken the handset from Jackson, who was lying close enough to pass it back and forth. It was so dark that Mellis felt suffocated. He couldn't see Jackson, even though he could touch him. Mellis leaned his head on the cold, dewy top of his rifle, the steel feeling cool and comforting against his forehead. The rest of his body ached with cold and damp. Only 6 hours until daylight. He wished he were back on the hill or back home in bed with the trees rustling outside the window. The school bus will be here pretty soon. Mommy will have breakfast ready. An anguished scream jerked Mellis awake, but it choked off immediately. It had come from the forward security post.
What the hell?
Mellis whispered. The entire squad was tense. He could feel the others, but no one could see a thing. They heard a grunting sound, a gruff cough that chilled Mellis through, and then the sound of brush crackling. Then nothing. Suddenly, the wire on Mellis's wrist was being tugged furiously again and again. There was no order, just wild tugging. Then they heard Cortell's voice. He was nearly hysterical, but he was still careful to whisper.
I'm coming in. I'm coming in. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, Lord Jesus.
They could hear him crawling along, hitting bushes in the dark. He was trying to follow the trail.
Oh, my Lord Jesus. Lieutenant! Jackson, where are you?
Over here, Cortell, Mellis said in a normal voice, trying to control his fear. The radio net burst into activity. The whole company had heard the scream, and Fitch was trying to determine what was happening. Mellis answered, It was us. I don't know what's happening yet. We're aborting the rampage. Over. Roger that. Someone reached out and pulled Cortell in. He was panting in short gasps. Jackson and Mellis crawled toward the sound, Mellis holding onto the handset and Jackson leading the way, the radio on his back. Both still had their poncho liners wrapped around them.
Hey, man, Jackson said. What's the matter?
Oh, Jesus, Jackson, it's Williams,
Cortell gasped out.
A tiger got him.
He all right?
He ate him, man. He jumped him and dragged him off and ate him. Lord God, we was just laying there, and all of a sudden there's William screaming, and I hear this tiger bat him, like, across the neck or something, and then crunch him right through the head.
Mellis couldn't see Cortell as he talked, but Cortell's voice conveyed his horror.
Oh, Lord God, sweet Jesus.
Jackson moved over, held on to Cortell, and talked to him in low tones.
Hey, man, it's all right. There's nothing you can do. Hey, man, take it easy, huh? Be cool.
Mellis keyed the handset. Bravo. This is Bravo One Actual. Our security was attacked by a tiger. We think he's dead. Can't see a goddamn thing. Over.
Jesus Christ,
Fitch's voice answered.
See if you can find him. Maybe he's just mauled. Over. I tell you, we can't see shit out here. I can't even see my radio when I'm using the goddamn thing. Over.
Roger that. Wait one. Mellis waited, sightless.
Jackson, tell everyone to set in tight and keep their ears open. Get Parker and Breuer in.
Right, sir.
Jackson slipped off the radio and crawled away, using the wire to guide him.
You all right, Cortell?
Mellis asked into the blackness.
Yes, sir.
Cortell's voice came back.
I'm okay now. Jesus, sir. I hope he ain't dead. But I heard his head go. I think it just popped open, sir.
The radio hissed a static burst. Fitch's voice came out of the handset.
We can shoot you some illumination rounds. Maybe it'll scare the cat off and you can find your man. Over.
Sounds fine. Go ahead on it. Over.
Roger that. Out.
Routine procedures like talking on radios seemed out of place to Mellis. Yet they didn't change, even if a tiger attacked. Mellis couldn't have been sure that anyone was still around him if it hadn't been for the sound of breathing.
Well,
he whispered into nothingness.
Nothing to do but wait. No sense getting all split up.
They waited 5 minutes. Then Fitch said, "Shot," over the radio.
"Shot out,"
Mellis repeated. Soon they heard the funny whiffling noise of the illumination shell. There was a pop high in the air to their south as the tiny parachute deployed. Then they could hear the hiss of burning phosphorus. The trail and jungle were cast into eerie, quavering relief. Jackson's and Cortell's faces shone through the mud and charcoal covering them. Jackson slipped back into the radio's carrying straps and Mellis rose.
Let's go. Cortell, you lead.
Cortell led off, rifle at the ready, Mellis directly behind him, followed by Jackson and the rest. They came to where Cortell and Williams had lain. The ground was slightly depressed, and both of their poncho liners were there as well as Williams' rifle. There was a dark stain of blood on the grass. They heard another illumination round, whiffling unseen with the sound of a small 4th of July rocket. Everything grew brighter again. As the round fell, vague, diffuse shadows changed position. They came across Williams's bush cover almost immediately. It was wet and stained with blood. It was also torn through. Mellis wondered if tigers defended their food and how far they dragged it to eat it. They kept looking, occasionally seeing a bit of blood. They fired off some rounds to frighten the tiger away. They had covered 100 meters when they came on Williams's body. His legs and backside had been ripped open and partially eaten. It looked as though he'd been killed with one quick blow to the skull, breaking his neck. Puncture wounds from long, sharp teeth were sunk deeply into his face and temples. They wrapped the mess in Williams's poncho liner and moved back up the trail toward the company, sweating and stumbling through the eerie light.
Chapter 7 Until dawn, Fitch pleaded for a helicopter. No choppers were flying. The rain and fog had shut down operations all over Northern I Corps. It would be suicidal to try to find Bravo Company in the mountains.
the order to blow the ammo cache stood. The squad threw fingers to divide up William's food and ammunition. Pellini won the throw for his poncho liner. Fredrickson and Bass wrapped Williams's body with comm wire to keep the torn pieces together. The body looked like beef in a cold storage locker, hardened blood mixed with pale skin and exposed meat. They tied the ankles, knees, elbows, and wrists closely together and then wrapped the torso in a poncho, leaving the arms and legs out. They tied the arms and legs to a long pole so they could carry the body, swinging, beneath it. Fredrickson wired William's head, which had been lolling loose inside the poncho, next to the pole so it wouldn't throw the carriers off balance. As the platoon sat waiting for Kendall's platoon to wind out of the perimeter, taking point, followed by Goodwin's platoon, Hawk came and sat quietly next to Bass and Mellis. The executive officer always walked with the last platoon in the column, tail end Charlie, lowering the risk that both he and the skipper would be killed at the same time. They were all aware of Williams's body in the olive-drab cocoon.
"Why couldn't it have been one of the worthless fuckers?" Bass asked.
His jaw began to tremble. He stood up quickly and started shouting at Skosh to get his ass in gear. Mellis looked at Hawk. "Because the world's not fair," he said quietly.
"There it is,"
Hawk answered. Eventually, 1st Platoon's own point men began to move, falling in behind Goodwin's last fire team. Mellis set off numbly, thankful not to have any responsibility for finding their way. He passed the pile of food supplies left for Delta. Then he was deep in jungle. The entire history of their stay, the holes they'd dug so laboriously, the hooches they'd set up, the place where he'd heated a cup of cocoa and talked with Hawk and Hamilton, the spot where he'd pissed, had been swallowed so totally that his memories seemed to be of dreams, not reality. The company left no more mark on the jungle than a ship's wake on the sea. By the second day, the body was little more than an inconvenience. The belly had swollen, and gas escaped occasionally from one end or the other. Rigor mortis had set in. The kids cursed it beneath their breath when they stumbled with it or slipped.
"God damn you, Williams, you fat pogue. You always ate too fucking much."
Whenever the company reached a relatively open space, Fitch asked for a chopper to come over and lower a hook so they could get rid of the body. He always got the same answer, no, though the reasons varied. Other priorities, poor weather. Once they sprang loose a Huey slick, but in the low clouds with rain slashing through the trees, the small chopper was unable to locate them, let alone get down close enough to lower a rope. The carriers would curse and pick Williams up, and he'd swing from side to side down the trail with them like a dead deer, his discolored hands bloated and puffed up around the wire. Skin had started to come loose from the muscles and slide down the fingers and arms, collecting where the fingers joined the hands and at the elbows, translucent and puckered like discarded surgical gloves. In the darkness, in the rain, they would lay him just inside the perimeter behind 3rd Squad's sector. During his watch, Cortell would talk quietly to the body, remembering what Mama Louisa had once told him back in Four Corners, that the soul could stay around 3 or 4 days before departing, getting used to the idea that it was dead. On the third night, Cortell crawled to the body and put his hands on the lump that was the head.
"Williams, I'm sorry. I might have done something but run. I didn't know. I was so scared. You know how scared you can get. You and me been scared like that, you know. I'm sorry, Williams. Oh, Jesus, I'm so sorry."
Cortell started to sob. Jackson, in the next hole, crawled across the ground and gently pulled Cortell away from the body, urging him silently back into his fighting hole, getting him to stop. The sobs could be heard too clearly, delineating the perimeter's position. And truly, on the fourth day, what was slung beneath the pole had no soul. It stank. Late that same afternoon, the company was stopped cold. Everyone sat down inboard outboard and leaned back wearily against his pack. The kids took swigs of plastic-tasting water from their canteens or started de-leaching. Some dozed off. It was soon apparent from the radio conversation that Lieutenant Kendall was lost again. Mellis pulled out his map. There was nothing to take bearings on. Clouds hid anything the jungle didn't hide. Mellis carefully reconstructed the terrain they'd passed through, dead reckoning their position. Finally, when he could stand it no longer, he slipped out of his pack and walked back along the line of tired Marines to find Hawk and Bass. Hamilton didn't get up to go with him. He closed his eyes and fell asleep. Mellis found Hawk and Bass already heating coffee in the old pear can, which Hawk carried tied to the outside of his pack for ready access. Hawk, who was squatting Vietnamese-style on the path next to the burning C-4, glanced up.
"Cut me some fucking slack, Mellis."
Hawk turned to Bass.
"I don't believe he smelled the coffee all the way up front."
"It's funny about him," Bass said. "I never seen him make his own cup of coffee, but he always knows when someone else is making one."
Mellis laughed and sat down in the mud with them. He started unfolding his map. Just then a static-riddled voice came from the radio handset, hooked on the strap of Scotia's pack. It was Kendall.
"Best I can figure, Bravo 6, we're at..."
There was a pause.
"From Chevrolet up 1.2 and right 3.4. Over."
Fitch's taut voice returned. "I copy." Fitch was already a full day late in reaching the next geographic checkpoint that had been assigned to him by Lieutenant Colonel Simpson. Mellis pulled the map over to where Bass and Hawk could see it. The day's radio code used cars for position reports. He found the prearranged coordinates of Chevrolet and traced out Kendall's reported position.
"He's crazy. We'd have to be over this ridgeline. We're by this riverbed, even if we've never seen it. You can feel the way the ground slopes."
Hawk looked at the map, grunted approval, and put the finishing touches on the coffee. The radio came to life again as someone keyed his handset. In the silence of the jungle, they all could clearly hear the person breathing.
"I don't think so, Bravo 3.
It was Fitch.
"I see us just about a click south of there by the blue line. Over."
There was a long silence. An error could bring their own artillery down on them. Worse, it could mean hours of extra walking.
"What a dingbat," Mellis said.
Hawk took a gulp of coffee, then handed the cup to Bass, who took a deep pull and handed it to Mellis, who did the same and passed it over to Skosh. The coffee burned delightfully all the way into Mellis's stomach, where he felt it radiate heat to his body. Sharing the cup felt good. It reminded him of passing around a joint. Hawk took another drink, put the steaming can on the mud, and took the radio handset.
"Bravo 6, this is Bravo 5, over."
"Yeah, 5,
Fitch returned.
"Bravo 1 Actual and I are back here with Bravo 1 Assist, and we've decided you're both fucked up. We're down 0.3 and right 4.5, over."
Daniels's voice crackled over the air.
"That's affirmative, Skipper."
There was a short pause, and Fitch came up on the hook again.
"Okay, I'll buy that. You copy that, Bravo 3? Over."
"Roger, I copy," said Kendall. "If that's where we are, I gotta come back out of this little draw because we're headed the wrong direction. Over."
"Jesus Christ," Bass muttered.
"Bravo 2, this is Bravo 6. You copy our pause? Over."
"Fuck yes, Jack. Over."
"Look, Scar, I know you're not due to walk point until tomorrow, but could you take it this afternoon so 3 can join our tail as we go by? Over."
There was a short pause while Goodwin weighed the request against the additional danger.
"Okay, Jack. Bravo 2, out."
Mellis left Hawk and Bass and worked his way forward to Hamilton, who gave him the handset.
"Skipper wants to talk to you," Hamilton said. From the tone of his voice, Mellis felt something had gone wrong.
"Bravo 6, this is Bravo 1 Actual. Over."
"Bravo 1, where the fuck you been? You don't go any place without your radio. Is that clear? You copy that? Over."
Mellis flushed and looked angrily at Hamilton, who had averted his eyes and was adjusting the heavy radio to ride better on his back.
Roger, I copy that.
Mellis knew that everyone on the radio net was aware of his mistake. He gave the handset back to Hamilton, saying nothing.
I should have gone with you, Hamilton mumbled. Sorry, sir, I won't let you down again.
Sorry won't get it, Mellis snapped. He reached down for his heavy pack and heaved it into place. He readjusted his ammunition bandoliers and took a long pull of brackish halazoned water.
Oh, hell. I should have known better myself, he said.
He handed Hamilton his open canteen. With Goodwin leading the way, Bravo Company lurched forward. Soon they were passing the disgusted-looking Marines from Kendall's platoon, who sat back in the low brush, rifles at the ready, watching the rest of the company file by. With Goodwin's platoon up front, they made faster progress, but it was still not fast enough for Colonel Simpson or Major Blakely, who began to ask Fitch for position reports almost hourly. By nightfall, the company was still 4 kilometers short of the ammunition site. The colonel radioed that the ammo was to be blown by noon the next day or he'd have Fitch relieved. This left Fitch with the alternative he dreaded, moving the company down into the river valley and taking the trail on which Alpha had been ambushed. As he checked holes that night, Mellis felt a subtle change in the atmosphere. A pocket of warm air, isolated in the monsoon, was going slowly toward the China Sea. By the time they were moving the next morning, heading down off the high ridgeline that afforded some breeze and the coolness of altitude, the air felt like a wool blanket pulled over their heads. To get down to the trail, they had to break out their ropes. Hands burned red and blisters erupted as they dangled down steep cliffs with heavy loads on their backs. Sweat stung their eyes. Tempers flared. Mellis felt as if he were having an asthma attack in a stuffy automobile. After 2 hours, they reached the trail that ran down the valley floor. It formed a narrow, muddy tunnel in the thick growth. Light barely penetrated the ceiling of overhanging vegetation. Goodwin waved the two Kit Carsons out in front, and the company jerked its way forward. The rate of progress was now nearly double what it had been off the trail. However, so was the danger. There was no longer any need to hack through bush and bamboo, but the fear of ambush still kept the pace agonizingly slow. Mellis fumed, wondering why blowing the dump by noon was better than blowing it that night. He wished they were up on the ridge where it was cooler and safer and the going was not much slower. After 2 more hours, Goodwin's platoon moved off the trail to allow Mellis's to take point. When he saw Goodwin, Mellis was too hot and tired to do anything except roll his eyes and let his tongue hang out.
"You ain't fucking wrong, Jack," Goodwin said in an almost normal tone of voice.
It seemed very loud. Those who heard him smiled. An hour later, the entire column had stopped. The kids stood dumbly in the heat, sweating, reeking, not wanting to move forward, yet wanting to get the day over with. Then some of them sat down. Soon the entire column was taking five with no one having given the word. Fitch came forward.
"What the fuck's going on?"
Mellis didn't know.
He knew he should have known.
He crawled forward, determined to get back in Fitch's good graces. He reached Jackson.
Jackson didn't know.
Mellis crawled on, Hamilton crawling after him. A small clearing opened up. The two Kit Carsons were cooking a meal listening to their transistor radio. Mellis was enraged. The lead Marine must have seen the Kit Carsons stop, but he hadn't been ordered to take point. Being on point was the Kit Carsons' bad luck. He wasn't about to volunteer to push past them and risk getting killed, especially since it meant walking across an open clearing. If the Kit Carsons weren't supposed to be cooking their meal, then an officer would probably wonder why the whole column had stopped and come up and investigate, as in fact happened. Mellis strode out of the cover of the jungle into the small patch of light.
"God damn you fucking gook assholes!"
He kicked the pot of water, scattering the burning C4.
"Get out of my goddamn sight!"
One of them reached for the pot, the other for his rifle. Mellis was too angry to feel threatened.
"Get the fuck out of here!" he screamed, shoving them toward the rear. back. You go to CP, you stupid motherfucker. Back. Me no want you. You, number 10.
He radioed Fitch that he was sending the Kit Carsons back and didn't want to see them up front again.
I don't want any fucking deserters fucking up my men, he shouted over the radio.
Fitch sighed. Just get us moving, okay? Out. Malice's contempt for anything Vietnamese grew. Fitch sent Aaron and Pat forward in hopes that Pat's nose would help speed things along. It didn't. An hour later, Malice saw Mallory sitting at the edge of the trail, his machine gun across his knees, holding his head and moaning with pain.
Come on, Mallory, Malice said. We've only got a few more hours to go. Then we'll blow the shit up and get our asses out of here.
The column filed wearily past them.
My head aches, Lieutenant,
Mallory said, nearly screaming.
I know. We're going to try and get you to a psychologist. Maybe he'll be able to help.
A loud groan escaped Mallory before he could cut it off.
A psychologist? Oh, shit, man. I tell you, it hurts. I'm not crazy.
Malice held out his hand, and Mallory struggled to his feet and humped up the trail, trying to regain his position in the line. Within minutes, they were again stopped dead. No one knew why. Malice wanted to sit down and guzzle water. A leech groped its way toward him, one end anchored to the ground while the other end arched up, blindly sensing the air. Malice began torturing it with his bottle of insect repellent. Disgusted with himself, he killed it with his boot. Hamilton walked up and offered the handset to Malice.
It's the skipper, he said.
Fitch's voice was testy. What's the fucking holdup now? Over.
I'm finding out now, Malice lied.
Well, hurry the fuck up. Malice groaned and struggled to his feet. Hamilton followed. They reached Jacobs, whose squad was now on point.
What's the story?
Malice whispered.
Pat alerted. Don't you ever pass the damn word back? Sorry, sir.
He gave Hamilton a quick, knowing look, which was returned. Malice caught the exchange. One more peevish lieutenant. He calmed down and moved forward with Hamilton creeping behind him, sweating under the load of the radio. They reached the dog and Aaron. Aaron squatted beside Pat, holding Pat's thick neck, his shotgun at the ready. Pat's tongue stuck out. The dog's lungs worked rapidly, trying to expel the heat. One of his reddish ears was folded half down as if it had wilted.
Small alert, sir, Aaron whispered. Robertson and Germaine are checking it out.
There was an uncertain pause.
Sir, Pat's done in. We've been on point 2 hours now.
Malice only nodded and continued forward, feeling more exposed with each step. He reached Germaine, the M-79 man, who was lying prone on the trail, trying to peer through the thick bamboo all around them. Malice and Hamilton crawled up to him.
Where's Robertson?
Malice whispered. Robertson was the leader of Jacobs' first fire team. Germaine turned his face, red with the heat and excitement, toward Malice and motioned with his hands in a wide arc. Robertson had chosen to move around to come up behind any possible enemy.
He went by himself?
Malice whispered. Germaine nodded and shrugged, still looking straight ahead. Malice was struck by Robertson's bravery. The radio hissed. Hamilton quickly muffled the handset against his shirt, but he listened to the words. He tapped Malice's boot.
It's the skipper. He wants to know what the fucking holdup is.
Malice grabbed the handset.
Bravo 6, we're checking it out, goddammit, over!
He had barely controlled the volume of his voice.
Roger, Bravo 1. I got Big John on my ass about the ammo getting blown. I'll give you 5 more minutes. Over.
Roger, out.
Malice gave Hamilton the handset.
The colonel's in a hurry,
he said to Hamilton bitterly.
Start moving forward, Germaine.
Germaine turned to look at him in surprise.
We got a cover for Robertson,
he said, exasperated.
Someone's got to care.
Malice started crawling forward past Germaine, who took a deep breath, and crawled out in front of him, his honor having been challenged.
Germaine,
a voice whispered from the jungle ahead of them.
Yeah, right here,
Germaine whispered back. There was a rustle in the bushes, and then Robertson's sweating face emerged. He was duck-walking.
Oh, hi, Lieutenant,
he said, and smiled. He remained there in a squat, his little body looking perfectly at ease in its folded-up position. Mellis turned to look at Hamilton.
Hi, Lieutenant, he says.
He shook his head and turned to Robertson.
See anything?
He asked. Robertson shook his head, obviously unfazed by Mellis's sarcastic tone.
I got the feeling, though, that they're just in front of us keeping tabs somehow.
Mellis became serious.
Why do you feel that? I don't know. Little things, I just feel it.
Mellis reached for the handset.
Bravo 6, this is Bravo 1 Actual. We checked out negative up here. I'll be rotating squads and then we'll be moving. I'm sending Aaron back. Pat's done and we'll have Big Victor.
He meant Vancouver. On point anyway.
Over.
Fitch acknowledged and Mellis stood up in the trail. Pass the word back for Conman's squad to move up. You guys take tail end Charlie, he told Jake. Tell Aaron to wait on the CP group. Pretty soon Vancouver's large frame could be seen moving up the trail, his modified M60 hanging from his neck. Connolly was just two men behind him. Mellis told the lead fire team and Connolly about the situation and the need for haste.
But don't go any faster than feels okay, Vancouver, he added. I don't care how much of a hurry the colonel is in to move his little pins in the map.
I got you, sir.
Vancouver stared down the trail, constantly scanning it, his eyes jerking with tension. Walking down a trail to save time, he knew, was an invitation for an ambush. Also, Robertson had smelled something. He was a good fire team leader and had been around a while. If Robertson was being cautious, there was good reason. But on point, there were always good reasons to be cautious, even if there's no hurry. The point man is all alone. It makes no difference if there's a fire team or an entire battalion behind him. He sees no one, only shadows. At every turn lurks the possible ambush, and the point man is the first to go. Or, if the ambushers are particularly successful, they let the point man by and cut him off when they open up on the lieutenant and the radio operator. It's like walking 100 feet up on a bending 2x4 with the wind blowing in sporadic gusts from different directions. There's no help. No rope. No friend to lean on. The point man is also blindfolded by the jungle. His ears are confused by every tiny sound behind him, obscuring the one sound that might save him. He wants to scream for the whole world to shut up. His hands sweat, making him worried that he won't be able to pull the trigger. He wants to piss even if he just pissed 5 minutes ago. His heart thumps in his throat and chest. He waits out the eternity before the squad leader says it's time to rotate back into safety. Vancouver stopped thinking. Fear and exposure drove thought from his head. Only survival remained. It was the oddly bent piece of bamboo about 10 meters down the trail that caused the rush of dread that saved him. Vancouver dropped to his knees and opened up. The roar of the machine gun and the spewing of hot casings turned the silent world of the jungle upside down. Everything was motion. Marines rolling off the trail, seeking cover in the foliage, scrambling, praying, crawling for their lives. Vancouver saw only shadows, but the shadows were screaming back at him with AK-47 automatic rifles. Bullets spun past him in the trail, kicking up mud, churning the place where the Marines had been a split second before. Connolly rolled into the brush, coming face up on his back, his M16 clutched to his chest. He was holding his fire, just as they had discussed so many times. The sawed-off M60 stopped firing. The belt had run out. Vancouver dived for the side of the trail, and Connolly rolled over into it on his stomach. He let loose on automatic just as an NVA soldier emerged from the wall of jungle to finish Vancouver off. Connolly's bullets caught the NVA soldier full in the chest and face. The back of the man's head exploded. Connolly rolled over again, fumbling wildly for another magazine. An M16 opened up on Vancouver's right, almost on top of him, the bullets screaming past his right ear. Then another M16 followed almost immediately to his left. Vancouver was crawling backward, along with Connolly, as fast as he could. Connolly was pushing a second magazine into place, shouting for Mole.
Gun up! Gun up! Mole, goddammit!
Vancouver pulled another belt of ammunition from the metal box on his chest and slapped it into the gun's receiver. He heard Connolly shouting for Gambaccini, the M79 man, and Ryder, his first fireteam leader. He saw the lieutenant, who'd moved forward and was shouting something at Hamilton and reloading a magazine himself. Then Gambaccini popped up and let loose with a grenade over Vancouver's head. There was a crashing sound in the brush to his left. He almost fired, but it was Ryder moving his team up. All four were abreast and to the left of the trail in the jungle. They began laying down disciplined fire, pouring bullets into the unseen enemy. To Mellis, the whole thing happened so quickly that he didn't even remember thinking. There was the sudden burst of Vancouver's machine gun, and Mellis dived for the ground and immediately started crawling forward to find out what was happening. Automatically, he started shouting for Mole to get the gun up front and heard the command being relayed back down the line. Fitch's excited voice was screaming over the radio. Mellis shouted at Hamilton,
"Tell him I don't know, I don't know,"
and crawled furiously forward. He had just crawled around a bend in the trail when Vancouver's gun stopped and he saw Connolly roll out, firing in front of him while Vancouver was scrambling backward. Mellis shoved his face into the dirt just behind Vancouver's right knee, poked his rifle blindly down the trail, and opened up over Vancouver's head. Almost simultaneously, it seemed, the M79 grenade launcher shot off a solid thump that sent a round of flechettes down the trail. Then a whole fire team crashed through the jungle on his left and opened up on full automatic. All this time, Connolly was also shouting for Mole and the machine gun, crawling backward. Mole came scrambling up the trail, gun cradled in his arms, crawling crab-like, awkwardly but very fast. His A-gunner, Young, the only white kid in the machine gun teams except for Hippie, crawled behind him, dragging the heavy steel boxes of machine gun belts. Mole slammed the gun down on its bipod just off the trail and immediately started laying disciplined bursts of fire down the dark green corridor. Tracers sped down the tunnel of jungle like the taillights of receding cars. Young crawled up next to the barrel, fresh belt in hand, eyes wide with fear, ready to reload. Mellis rolled back and grabbed the hook from Hamilton, panting for air.
"Ambush! I knew this fucking trail! Death trap! Vancouver spotted them! Before we got into the kill zone, I think they DD'd. Over!"
"Casualties? Over."
"That's a neg. Over."
"Thank God," Fitch replied, forgetting radio procedure.
Mellis was quivering with excitement and with a strange exultation, as if his team had just won a football championship.
No casualties.
He'd done well.
It was over too quickly, though.
Somehow it should be prolonged. He wanted to tell Fitch and Hawk all about it. He wanted to go running down the long line of excited Marines, telling the story of the fight over and over again. They'd broken up an ambush. His platoon. Killed two, maybe three of the enemy, and suffered not a scratch. A perfect job.
"Bravo 6, this is Bravo 1, over."
"Bravo 6, Fitch answered.
"We need artillery,"
Mellis pleaded excitedly.
"The goddamn gooners are DD'ing right out of the fucking area. Where's the goddamn mortars? Let's get some."
"Roger that, Bravo 1. Character Delta's working up an arty mission right now. It's a little hard on the mortar squad to fire shells into the tree limbs over their heads. You copy? Over."
Mellis was too excited to notice Fitch's sarcasm. He crawled over to where Connolly was lying beside Mole, peering down the shadowy trail. Connolly, too, was quivering and breathing hard. Vancouver was to Connolly's left, and Ryder's fire team to the left of Vancouver, pulled back now in echelon, forming the left side of a wedge. The rest of the squad, without being told, had formed the right side of the wedge at the head of the column to get maximum fire in the direction of the ambush, but still allow fire to their sides to protect their flanks.
"I think they drug the body away, sir," Connolly said. "Just as we was crawling back, I thought I caught some movement. Did you see them?"
"Yeah," Mellis lied, without intending to. "You're right.
In his imagination, fueled by the excitement, this mention of an NVA soldier pulling a body back into the cover of the jungle was enough to convince him that he'd actually seen it happen.
"Why doesn't the skipper send a platoon around in an envelopment?"
he asked, staring down the trail. Connolly looked at Mellis.
"In this shit?"
Mellis stopped gazing straight ahead and looked at Connolly. For some reason, that comment had brought him down. Once more, he saw a tangled jungle on both sides of a narrow, muddy path. Yeah, it'd take forever. They'd be sitting ducks. You'd hear them for miles.
"There it is, sir."
"Maybe we can get it on with the artillery." Mellis wanted to keep talking about the incident.
"You sure about the gook you zapped in the head?"
he asked.
"I saw his fucking face disappear,"
Connolly said grimly. "We'll call it a confirmed, even if we don't have the body. I mean, there's no way the gooner can still be alive. Vancouver must have greased at least another one or two." Mellis turned to Vancouver.
"Hey, Vancouver, how many you think you got?"
Vancouver looked down at his steaming weapon.
"Gee, sir, all I saw was fucking bushes, and all this shit came flying at me. I maybe hit a couple of them, though."
"We'll look for blood trail soon as the Artie mission's over. But we must have got at least one confirmed and two probables."
Mellis turned around to where Hamilton was lying with the heavy radio pressing him into the dirt, its small bent antenna waving in the still air. He proudly reported the score.
"Bravo, this is one. We got one confirmed up here and two probables. Over."
"Roger, one confirmed and two probables,"
Palak's voice answered.
"Heads down." "I just heard Character Delta say shot. He'll be working it in close. Over."
"Incoming," Mellis called out in a loud voice. "Friendly incoming."
He looked around to see if his men were reasonably safe. Then it occurred to him that everybody already had his head down and had been that way for the past 3 minutes. He buried his own head in the earth as the first anguished scream of the 105s came through the sky from Eiger. It was again Third Squad's turn to take point. They handed off Williams's body to Second Squad and moved quietly forward. Cortell kept taking his helmet off and putting it on, rubbing his high, glistening forehead. Everyone hurried through the would-be kill zone, breathing a thank you for Vancouver's eyes and reaction time. Jackson found two rice cakes hanging from a man's bloody web belt that had been removed and tossed beside the trail. He happily stuffed them into his large trouser pockets, as all of his squad's food was gone. He quickly cut the brass buckle with its red star from the belt, knowing it would bring some good money from the souvenir hunters in Da Nang, and passed it back to Vancouver. A little farther down the trail, they found a bloody cap. That also was passed back to Vancouver, who silently gave it to Connolly. Connolly stuffed it into his pocket. Mellis's whole body was zinging. His hands quivered. He started at nearly every noise and talked too rapidly and too much on the radio. He kept mentally replaying the scene, wondering how he could have reacted faster and killed more of them, wondering if Connolly was aware that, while he was changing magazines, Mellis had saved him by firing. He wondered if people outside the company would hear about his action and how his platoon had succeeded when Alpha Company had lost so many in a similar ambush. He remained charged up until they reached the ammunition dump that afternoon as the light began to fade from the gray sky. At the dump, Mellis was bitterly disappointed. He couldn't believe that all the reports he'd read about the Air Force and Navy destroying bunkers had referred to what he saw before him. Three large holes dug in the dank ground covered with logs and earth. Inside the three bunkers were 10 120-millimeter rockets, several hundred 82-millimeter mortar shells, 80 small 61-millimeter mortar shells, enough AK-47 ammunition to supply a platoon for one firefight, and a few medical supplies donated by the English Red Cross. Hawk seemed strangely happy. He broke into the Hawk dance, then climbed on top of one of the bunkers and tossed bandage rolls in the air like streamers, shouting at the top of his lungs,
"The fucking English! I knew it was the fucking English behind this war!"
He laughed and tossed another bandage, looping it in the trees.
The whiteness looked out of place against the dark canopy. The company mostly shrugged at the Jayhawks' antics. Cassidy organized a work party, and soon the ammunition was hauled into a pit where he, Sams, Bass, and Ridlow joyfully collaborated in blowing it up. Everyone buried his head in the earth, and they set off the charge. There was a tremendous explosion, but not even a quarter of the ammunition went off. The rest twisted skyward, tumbling end over end and scattered across the area. The kids booed. Cassidy laughed and immediately put the booers to work collecting the ammunition. The Marines on the work detail grumbled. We must have the only fucking lifers in the crotch that can't blow up a fucking ammo dump. They waited for an hour to make sure there were no cook-offs in the pit and once more set the charges. This time they covered the ammo with rocks and earth to contain the explosion. The platoon sergeants themselves were laughing about the incongruity of the situation. Most people would think they couldn't light a match around an ammo dump without setting it off. Basically, everyone was happy. They would probably clear an LZ the next morning and sky out by afternoon, their mission accomplished with no casualties other than Williams. Mellis, however, felt a curious malaise, anxiety, and an emptiness beyond hunger. He had been on half rations for 5 days and had eaten nothing at all today. Four thoughts kept hammering at him. First, how could the English, seemingly the most civilized of people, the people with whom they'd fought side by side against the Nazis, be aiding their enemy, the North Vietnamese Army? Every penny that the North Vietnamese saved by receiving donations could be spent on ammunition that could kill him. Every life saved was a life that could kill him, too. Mellis felt betrayed. Second, he was still trying to reconcile those tiny log-covered pits referred to as bunkers with the images in his mind of bombs smashing concrete and steel, the Siegfried Line, the guns of Navarone. Third, why in hell had they walked all this way, sacrificed Williams, and nearly killed the entire first squad, but for Vancouver's uncommon alertness, for no more ammunition than could be hauled off with a couple of trucks? These thoughts nagged at him as he struggled to dig his hole for the night. When he finished, he sat down to face the fourth question. Should he make his last cup of coffee now or in the morning? The platoon was just about out of food. He decided to wait. He went off to find Hawk and Fitch to talk about medals for the action, half hoping that maybe he'd get one too, but at the same time realizing that all he'd really done was show up for the party. He also hoped Hawk and Fitch would be fixing coffee. Fitch was on the hook with the three, who had questions of his own, to which Fitch had the wrong answers. I was informed that there were three ammunition bunkers in this complex. These numbers you've given us just don't jibe. Over. Fitch took a deep breath and looked at Hawk before answering. Palak rolled his eyes.
That's affirmative. Three bunkers. We got them all. The numbers you got are everything that's in them. They're little bunkers. Over.
I copy. There was a burst of static as Blakely released his transmitting button. Fitch waited nervously. Static burst out again.
Stand by for a frag order, Bravo 6. Over. Roger, you're last. Bravo 6 out.
A fragment order on the original? Mellis asked, uneasy about any change. Does that mean we're not skying out tomorrow? Fitch shrugged.
Maybe something to do with Delta Company over the ridge. Hell, we can't go far with everyone out of food.
Not quite everyone, Hawk said, digging into the side pocket of his utility trousers. He held up a single can of apricots. Everyone looked at it longingly.
And I ain't opening it.
Hawk stuffed it back into his pocket.
I got a bad feeling about that frag order.
At the regimental briefing that afternoon, Major Adams was particularly snappy.
Whap! And at coordinates 768671, elements of Bravo 124 destroyed the ammunition dump, uncovered by Alpha Company and believed to be one of the supply sources for elements of the 312th Steel Division, now known to be operating in RTAOR, approximately 5 tons of ammunition consisting of 120-millimeter rockets, small arms and automatic weapons ammunition, and mortar rounds were destroyed along with approximately 1,000 pounds of medical supplies.
Better leave the medical supplies out of the report, Mulvaney said. No sense getting someone riled up about destroying medical supplies.
Somehow the public felt it was okay to kill men with tumbling bullets and flaming jelly, but to kill them by denying them medical supplies was against some societal notion of decency.
Aye, aye, sir,
Adams answered. Mulvaney turned stiffly in his chair to look back at Colonel Simpson and Major Blakely, who were seated behind him.
Maybe you do have some gooks out there, Simpson, he said.
Blakely smiled and looked up at Adams, whose face revealed a twinge of jealousy. Mulvaney turned back to face the briefing officer. He was trying to figure out how many men and how long it would take to haul 5 tons to such a remote location. Through terrain like that, it was quite an accomplishment. He had to admire the North Vietnamese Army. But why were they stacking ammunition there? Was it a way station for moving the ammunition farther south? They could hit Hue again. Now that would be a fucking propaganda disaster. Let the politicians chew on that for a while. But then they might also be preparing a move in force straight across Mutter's Ridge, where they'd control Route 9 and then starve out VCB. Now that they'd abandoned Matterhorn to get enough troops to do the stupid fucking Comlo political operation, that would be what he'd do if he were a gook. He suddenly felt, in the middle of his back, the uneasiness that had saved him so often in Korea and the Pacific. Then he noticed Major Adams waiting nervously to continue, sighed and nodded his large head. He couldn't cover everywhere.
Whap!
The pointer moved to the left, 3/4 of an inch, the distance it had taken Bravo Company half a day to move. As the colonel is aware, Bravo made point-to-point contact with an undetermined size unit of North Vietnamese infantry at grid coordinates 735649 earlier today. 2 confirmed kills and 3 probables with no casualties suffered by Bravo Company, the bodies were searched with negative findings. Mulvaney turned to look at Blakely and Simpson.
Someone must have really been on their toes out there, he said. Was it a point-to-point or an ambush?
In fact, Mulvaney already knew that it was the big blonde Canadian kid with the sawed-off M60 who had busted up an ambush. His Jeep driver had the story from one of the 1st Battalion radio operators. Bravo's skipper must have been in an awful hurry to be barrel-assing down a trail another company had already been hit on. That young lieutenant was lucky. Probably hadn't learned when to charge and when not to. Mulvaney would have to talk to him about it if he got the chance. Simpson cleared his throat, his face reddening.
In answer to your question, sir, Bravo's point man apparently fired first, and the lead squad pulled back and set up. We called it a point-to-point contact because it seemed the most conservative.
Mulvaney grunted and turned to endure the remainder of the briefing. Why in fuck Simpson should worry about breaking up an ambush was beyond him. After suffering through hearing the Navy doctor tell how many Marines went through his sick bay, the Congressional Inquiries officer tell how many letters he'd handled from upset congressmen responding to letters from upset mothers and wives, and the Red Cross liaison man tell about dependents who were not getting pay allotments, Mulvaney could finally rise from his chair to address his officers.
As you already know, gentlemen, the 5th Marine Division continues to be involved in a combined cordon and search operation with the 1st Arvin Division. Our major objective, as you also know, continues to be Camlo.
Mulvaney turned to the large map and began outlining the next day's plan of the ongoing operation, all the while feeling that somehow he had let his regiment down. Working with the goddamn gooks wasn't his idea of fighting a war, particularly when all that would probably happen was a few old political scores would get settled in Camlo. Some SEAL teams had been operating in the villages for several years now, assassinating known Viet Cong leaders, but where the fuck did that information come from?
supposedly from the CIA, but then none of those spooks were hanging out in the villages. Christ, they're all 6'2" white boys from Yale. So where did the spooks get their information? Probably from one of the damn secret societies who were just fingering a leader of another secret society over the control of some drug market and getting their dirty work done courtesy of the United States Navy. Any Viet Cong leadership, if the Viet Cong existed in any force there at all, after their buddies from the North set them up to be obliterated by American firepower during Tet, would be long gone by the time all the security leaks from the Arvin trickled down. Yes, Mulvaney mused. Power in the secret societies would definitely shift after Comlo, and the spooks would be played for suckers, and his Marines would pay the price. He wanted to kick the CIA's ass and break the fucking Arvin's scrawny necks.
Simpson, he said, I'm going to have to disappoint you. We'll have to abandon the Matterhorn area for good. I can't afford to give up any of Mutter's Ridge. Lookout and Sherpa keep me covered in the Kaysan region. Division wants a new fire support base opened up at Hill 1609 just beneath Tiger's Tooth. We'll have to bring in those two companies in the Matterhorn area and then send one of them out close enough to open 1609.
But, sir, Simpson stood up, excited, already believing the numbers he'd estimated for his report. We're just beginning to find what's really up there. He turned to look to Blakely for support. Blakely didn't miss his cue.
I'm sure the regimental commander realizes, Blakely began, that with the latest findings of Bravo Company combined with the intelligence estimates of division, there's a high probability that the NVA is becoming quite active in the far northwest. It would be a real shame after having given those reports to division to have no follow-through on them.
Mulvaney almost exploded. The last goddamn thing on his mind was following up on some fucking report he'd turned into division. Then he remembered his wife. He counted to five. Then he counted five more. His mind went back to that night at Camp Lejeune. It must have been 1954 or 1955. He was still a captain in any case. He had Alpha Company, 2nd Marines. Maisie had come back from bridge with Neitzel's wife, Dorothy, and some of her cronies. Neitzel was already a major and was heading for amphibious warfare school and a big staff job. Mulvaney had been painting the living room, little James slung in a beach towel hanging from his neck.
My God, Mike, Maisie said. You're getting paint all over him, and the fumes. The girl's bedroom must be full of them.
She was smiling and shaking her head, at the same time removing her impeccable white gloves and placing them where they always resided, in her grandmother's crystal bowl, the only thing she had ever inherited. She grabbed the apron that always hung on the kitchen door hook and tossed it over her shoulder to protect her only suit. She took the baby from him. "Wouldn't sleep again?" she asked.
"Yep."
"Girls go to bed on time?"
"Yep."
"Can you put the roller down?"
"Uh-oh, serious scuttlebutt."
He put the roller in the tray and watched her watching little James so that she wouldn't have to look him in the eye. He knew that she never wanted to hurt his feelings, but he also knew that she didn't shirk from delivering bad news if it meant a better life for her kids. That same drive had her memorizing bidding rules, with him quizzing her from a book while she ironed clothes so she wouldn't make a damned fool of herself in front of the other wives. That same anxiety had also had her agonizing with her sister at Christmas time about what suit to buy when she had first been invited to the bridge table, as if her sister knew more about suits than Maisie did because she worked in a real office.
"Dorothy Neitzel did it as a favor, so I don't want you to take it in the wrong way. She really is trying to help."
He watched her glance up at him and then quickly back down at James.
"Help how? Might as well get it over."
"You know, what do you guys call it? Back-channel communication?"
"Gossip," she laughed.
"That's what we call it."
Then she looked at him seriously.
"Oh, Mikey,"
she said, her eyes pleading.
"Dorothy says you stood up for that awful alcoholic First Sergeant Hanford who got caught trying to divert base water to some sort of some sort of swimming hole or something that he'd dug out with a bulldozer that he'd, what do you call it, requisitioned from the engineering battalion without asking them for it? We call that stealing.
It gets goddamn hot in those stupid squad bays, and those kids loved it. I told the colonel that all Hanford needed was an off-the-record chewing out. Instead, they busted him. He's got four kids. All he was doing was looking out for the troops. You know what I told you that day you picked me up from the hospital?
Yes, I know that you'd always take the side of the Bush Marine.
She sighed.
Mikey, of course you're right, but on that very same day, in my father's 1939 Chevy, I was driving because your leg still wouldn't work from Okinawa. I told you that there might be times that you could be a little more circumspect. You can do a lot more good for your Bush Marines as a colonel than as a captain.
He took a quick, God help me, look at the ceiling. Hanford did the right thing the wrong way. No harm, no foul.
The harm, Michael, was telling the colonel that if he ever got his fat ass out of his air-conditioned office, he'd understand what Hanford was trying to do.
Mulvaney tightened his lips and folded his arms across the chest.
Don't you get stubborn with me, Michael Mulvaney. You were wrong to do it. Can't you think of your own family, your own kids, for once?
That's unfair. She breathed, softened.
Yes, it was.
She reached out to touch his arm.
But, Mikey, please, you've got to hold your temper.
His temper had been an issue ever since he'd gotten back from the Pacific. She moved her hand back to the baby.
Do you want to know what else Dorothy told me?
I can't wait.
She is doing us a favor, Mikey, for God's sake.
Mulvaney sat down on the tarp-covered couch and looked up at her. Go ahead, already on the firing line. She sat down beside him, scrunching sideways, her tight skirt riding up to show the welt of her stocking, something that always distracted Mulvaney. She tugged, unsuccessfully, at the skirt with her right hand, trying to keep James on her shoulder with her left and Mulvaney on task. She solved both problems by putting the baby in the apron across her lap. She pointed a finger at him, eyes merry.
You are always horny.
So? I'm on the firing line anyway. Shoot me.
Later.
She smiled down at the baby and said in a quiet sing-song,
Daddy wants to make you a little sister.
Then she looked up at Mulvaney, her large green eyes suddenly serious.
Dorothy says that they all think you're...
She hesitated. Go on.
That you're some kind of a throwback to World War II. The word is that Mulvaney will never get out of the jungle, but he's good in a fight.
That's bad?
Oh, Mikey, don't be deliberately dense. You know as well as I do that it's the planners that get ahead, not the fighters.
And the politicians.
Yes!
She stamped one black pump on the floor and rose to her feet. Putting the baby back on her shoulder, she walked quickly into their bedroom, where the crib was next to the bed, her two-inch heels punctuating every step. He had watched the way her tight wool skirt beautifully molded her rear end. The briefing room swam back into consciousness, a layer above the memory of his home and his wife. God, how he missed her now. He saw everyone waiting for him to say something. He knew Blakely was right. With promising reports coming in from Bravo Company, it would look foolish not to follow through.
But where in hell am I supposed to get the men to follow up on your fucking reports?
He asked. He was uncomfortably aware that his strangled anger at Blakely and the Arvins made his voice sound petty and whining. Blakely thought quickly.
Why not let Bravo Company sweep the area and move up to 1609 on foot, sir?
Mulvaney looked at the map. It looked like a little over 20 kilometers as the crow flies. But the small squares were almost completely brown with the thick mass of 20-meter contour intervals. They could barely fit next to each other and still be distinguishable. He remembered parts of Korea that looked like this, and he shuddered. There hadn't been any jungle there.
"What's their condition?"
he asked Simpson.
"They've been out in the bush a long time, if I remember."
"Top-notch, sir. They could be there in 4 days."
If Simpson said 4 days, then it would probably take 8.
Food? Power sources for the radios? Ammo?
With this Cam Low op, you know I'm short on birds for resupply.
No problem, sir,
Simpson replied, enjoying the chance to show the other battalion commanders how ready his battalion was. Blakely paled and swallowed. He hadn't bothered to tell Simpson that Bravo had given half its food to Delta almost a week ago to cover the error of pushing Delta off inadequately supplied.
What do you think, Major Blakely?
Mulvaney asked. Blakely didn't hesitate.
124 can do the job, sir. You know what they say about the impossible.
Yes, Mulvaney said quietly, turning to look at the map. It takes a little longer.
Sick, frostbitten Marines crowded into his memory, struggling up frozen hills, their backs bent under mortars and ammunition, the wounded strapped on litters bound to fenders and in the backs of jeeps and small trucks, clenching their teeth at each painful jolt. Then his mind contrasted that image with one of thin, sore-ridden bodies with barely enough energy to fight the jungle, let alone fight the Japanese. He forced his mind back to the brightly lit briefing room and the map in front of him. He figured it would be a fucking hump at that. Still, he could live with it. They had 10 days before 1609 had to be secured. That left Bravo 2 real days of wiggle room. Something, however, nagged at him. It was like a lump beneath a sleeping bag that he couldn't quite flatten. But with that much ammo in that dump, and if he didn't follow through on it as Blakely had suggested, he knew he had a reputation for being too impetuous. In this new Marine Corps of careful staff work and covering your ass with paper, it just wasn't the same. His old friend Neitzel had blended right in with the new Corps. That was why Neitzel had a division and Mulvaney didn't. If they hit pay dirt, it couldn't hurt his chances of becoming a general. He smiled, imagining his wife pinning on his stars.
Oh, hell, he growled at himself.
Sir?
Major Adams responded.
Nothing, Adams. Okay, Simpson, you're on. Don't let me down.
The frag order that appended their original order to destroy the supply dump reached Bravo Company 1 hour after the regimental briefing broke up. It consisted of a series of checkpoints and times of arrival, nothing more, some in deep draws, others high on ridges. The line of march took no heed of the wild terrain. Hawk began the actuals meeting.
"Gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to our new leader, Captain Meriwether Lewis. My name is Clark, but you can call me WM for short. We won't be skying out for a while."
Fitch explained the frag order.
"We've got about 3 hours of daylight left, so we might as well get a couple of hours humping. Otherwise, there's no chance of making checkpoint Alpha."
"Shit," Mellis said. "We just dug in. That body stinks and my platoon's out of food."
"You ain't the Lone Ranger, Mellis," Hawk said. "But you might be Sacagawea. You still got point."
Mellis gritted his teeth and took his map out of his pocket, but he had to smile at Hawk's joke.
"I don't see any point in it, that's all," he said.
People groaned and Mellis felt better.
"What about this funny-looking three-cornered hill for a position for tonight?" he said. "We might make it before dark. Jesus, though, the river looks like it runs right through a fucking canyon."
They discussed it briefly, and Fitch gave the go-ahead. He ordered the food redistributed, but would allow anyone to keep one sea ration can if he had one, mitigating any resentment on the part of those who had saved their rations. Most of the kids, like Mellis, had already eaten all the food they had. The platoon sergeants collected everything that remained. The redistributed food, now held in common, equaled about 3/4 of a can per person. 20 minutes after redistributing the food, the company wound out of the ammunition dump. Jacobs's squad leading, Jackson struggling with Williams' body. They moved slowly northeastward, following a rushing stream, higher into the mountains, closer to the DMZ. The terrain grew wildly beautiful, with steep jungle-covered peaks and rushing torrents of water from the monsoon rains. Occasionally, someone would slip on a glassy, water-smoothed rock, and his entire body would be covered in swift white water that immediately soaked into his pack, wetting his poncho liner. Unable to regain his feet against the force of the stream because of all his heavy gear, he would be pulled up by laughing companions. Those who got soaked, however, knew that they'd be fighting the cold all that night, trying to use body heat to dry their clothes and poncho liners. The trees grew larger and the forest darker as they gained altitude. At one point, a large, flat outcropping of rock opened the jungle enough to afford them a view of their line of march. Directly in front of them was a dark, narrow valley filled with clouds, which hung close to dark peaks of barren rock. The peaks guarded a narrow, twisting river. Each Marine who passed that open viewpoint made some nervous gesture, tightening his equipment, pausing to spray repellent on a leech, whistling aloud. The rain, which up to now had been falling in a misty drizzle from high clouds, suddenly intensified. It pounded the earth, bringing a rush of cold air. By the time they reached the three-cornered hill, Melis had an intense headache because of his depleted blood sugar. His body had been drained by onslaughts of adrenaline, hunger, and the constant sucking cold of wet clothing. Feeling like a sick animal, he dragged himself along by will alone. The hill rose impossibly high in the gloom. Jacobs looked upward.
"Who the fuck picked this?"
Water from the stream at the base of the hill was dripping from his trousers. Melis closed his eyes. "I did, asshole." The point man sighed, then started crawling up the slope, pushing his rifle in front of him, grabbing roots and rocks. Partway up, Melis heard a commotion behind him. He turned to see Hippie looking helplessly up the hill as he slid backward, his heavy machine gun held in front of his face. He started knocking into people behind him, who in turn started to slide and knock into others. The whole slow-motion scene came to a halt against a tree, and everyone untangled himself, cursing Hippie. They started upward again. It took Melis's platoon an hour to reach the top while the rest of the company waited in the rushing river, freezing, exposed to attack, as the light faded completely. Melis, as the first officer in, was responsible for setting in the defense for the company and guiding the Marines into positions as they arrived. He thrashed his way through the dark jungle with a machete, outlining the perimeter. It was all he could do to keep from falling to the forest floor, never to move again. Tangled growth slapped his face, tore at his exposed skin, hid the terrain from his eyes. He kept trying to remember all the rules about placing his machine guns. His E-tool, the small folding entrenching shovel attached to his pack, caught on a branch, and the sudden imbalance with the immense weight of his pack almost pulled him over backward. He struck out at the limb, breaking it, hurting his hand and opening the scab over a jungle rot sore on his arm. In a frenzy, he took out his K-bar and hacked the bush to pieces. Afterward, his face felt hot and flushed, but his back was damp and cold. His hands were swollen, and his fingers did not want to move. He pulled down his trousers and shit watery feces that spattered on his bare legs and boots. He retched at the smell, unable to throw up because his stomach was empty. He headed back down the hill to guide his weary platoon in. It took the rest of the company an hour to get to the top because First Platoon's trail had turned into a mudslide. When Melis finally was able to return to his own position, he found Hamilton with the dry heaves from exhaustion and lack of food, retching painfully over the beginnings of a shallow hole. Melis watched him, realizing that he'd have to dig the entire hole himself. "Here, give me that," Melis said bitterly, taking the small entrenching tool. "Why don't you see if you can rig our ponchos up for some sort of hooch?" he said more gently. Hamilton tried to smile, but began retching again.
"I'll be okay in a while, sir," he gasped. "Don't worry, I'll help with the hole."
"Forget it," Melis said. He started digging. When Hamilton turned away, Melis began silently crying, hacking at the damp earth in impotent fury. Fitch had said there would be a full moon that night, and indeed the monsoon clouds had lightened just enough to permit an eerie glow above the trees when Melis did his first hole check. He found Hippie sitting silently on the edge of his hole. His bare feet dangled into the darkness below him, and his ragged, bleached-out boots sat next to the hole.
"You'd better cover those boots, Hippie," Melis whispered. "I homed in on them like an airport beacon.
Thanks, sir.